This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We just exited the hottest month ever recorded. The European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Service reported July 2019 was 0.04 degrees Celsius warmer than the previous record set in July 3 years ago. The record comes after the hottest June ever recorded earlier this summer. And the news only gets balmier from there. In Cincinnati, we usually get a dozen and a half days each year with a heat index above 90 degrees. The heat index is what it feels like outside and is often a few degrees or more higher than the actual temperature. But a new study by the Union of Concerned Scientists shows by the end of the 21st century, we could see more than 90 such days each year. Joining Cincinnati Edition to discuss is Union of Concerned Scientists Senior Climate Scientist Rachel Licker. She's on the phone with us. Thanks for joining us, Rachel.
Having me, Michael.
The number to join the conversation today is 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. So, Rachel, before we talk about the Midwest specifically, what's happening? Why are we seeing hotter summers across the world?
Well, extreme heat is one of the climate changes that is most responsive to greenhouse gas emissions. So simply as we're increasing the amount of heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere, temperatures are warming up and our extreme temperatures are getting hotter.
What is the Union of Concerned Scientists, this group that you're part of and that put out this report?
Yeah, so we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization where we try to put the best, most credible science to work to both conduct research in-house, like the study that we're talking about today, and we also try to advocate for policies based on research to help create a safer future, a healthier planet and population, and ensure that we have a robust research enterprise to be able to do science.
And the name of this report is Killer Heat in the United States, Climate Choices and the Future of Dangerously Hot Days. So you guys aren't mincing words here. I mean, are lives at stake?
Yeah, so heat is currently one of the top weather-related causes of death in the United States. And it's actually the number of deaths that we know and have figures for is actually underreported because heat causes many more deaths and contributes to many more deaths than goes on record. And certainly as temperatures get warmer, that is going to get worse.
What would we notice day to day if the number of days with these heat indices above 90 quadruple in the Cincinnati area?
Well, it would certainly have implications for many different aspects of daily life at home, at school, at work. One of the thresholds that we looked at was the number of days, as you mentioned, above 90 degrees Fahrenheit. And one of the reasons that we looked at that particular threshold was because that's particularly relevant for outdoor workers. Above 90 degrees Fahrenheit, our National Occupational Safety and Health Administration recommends that employers start taking measures to protect outdoor workers. So you can think of our farmers, our postal workers, police officers, and also, construction workers, people working in the military who are outdoors. Also, there's new research to show that as temperatures increase outdoors, that can actually have an impact on student performance and test scores. And certainly, if we have to run ACs more to stay cool, that's going to affect our pocketbooks and home energy bills. So it's really something that is pretty insidious in that it affects many aspects of our daily life.
And yeah, I guess as it gets hotter and we try to stay inside to avoid that, and we do run whatever mechanisms we have to keep cool inside, a lot of those machines are, I guess, part of the problem here, are they not?
That's exactly right. And you can think of that from a few different perspectives. If you need to run air conditioning units more and more to stay cool and we are running them off of fossil fuels, that's going to contribute to climate change and make the chances for these kinds of increases in extreme temperatures more likely. Then you also have a situation in which during extreme heat when we're running more of these kinds of AC units, you know, that requires a lot of energy, and oftentimes communities have to bring their peaker plants, that's what they're known as, the dirtier power plants, online to produce that energy and meet that demand. And that can actually cause air pollution issues and exacerbate health consequences, too. So, you know, that's the negative spiral, but you can also think of it in the positive. If we invest in clean energy, you know, we can kind of break that cycle and create win-win-wins for climate change, energy use, and human health.
This new report focuses on heat, and a lot of times when winter rolls around here in the Midwest, in Cincinnati, and we get a heavy snowfall, you'll often have some jokesters on social media say, where's global warming? Where's global warming? But we're seeing some pretty extreme winter conditions too, aren't we?
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly the number of record colds versus the number of record high temperatures that's being set, we're seeing less and less of those record cold temperatures. But, you know, obviously we had some cold temperatures because of, you know, what's going on in the Arctic with climate change. Is sometimes one of my colleagues calls it, it's kind of like leaving the freezer door open. So, you know, as things are warming up down there, that's affecting the jet stream and affecting some of the regional circulation patterns and can actually lead to some of the cooler temperatures that we've been seeing during the winter time. It's all connected.
Yeah, we saw last week that 12.5 billion tons of ice lost in Greenland in one day.
Yes.
And so we see headlines like that and we can shake our heads and look concerned, but you're a scientist. I'm not. And I imagine most of us who are listening right now are not. So how do we, you know, the general non-scientific population, how do we fully wrap our heads around what that means to lose 500 million tons of ice in Greenland in one day?
Yeah, well, we are seeing, you know, these increases in glacier and ice sheet melt and loss, you know, and it's something that fit in with the projections that we have been showing. You know, as we increase the amount of heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere, the whole Earth is going to warm, not just on land, but in our oceans, and our Arctics are kind of one of the frontline areas, if you will, or kind of the canary in the coal mine where, you know, even in Alaska, communities there are seeing a lot of changes too already. And so we really, you know, sometimes need to turn to those parts of the Earth to see signals of how climate change is already manifesting.
This new report broke down details about each state and what could be expected in each of them, even calling out specific cities that could be impacted the most. And we're going to talk about those in just a moment. But I'm curious, based on your research and what your organization knows, are there parts of the country that are more vulnerable to this changing climate?
Certainly. And there are a couple of different ways to think about this because different parts of the country have different levels of experience and preparedness for extreme heat. In terms of the amount of days above some of the extreme heat thresholds that we looked at, the Southeast and Southern Great Plains regions will, under any scenario, face the most frequent and intense episodes of extreme heat. We found by mid-century, with no action, 25 counties in Florida and 57 in Texas would experience an average of 100 days or more per year with a heat index above 100. So that's, you know, you can think of that like spending the equivalent of all of June, July, and August in those kinds of hot temperatures. But, you know, on the flip side, if you think about some of the northern parts of the country, you can think about Wisconsin, Montana, et cetera, those are parts of the country that don't have the experience and necessarily the preparedness for extreme heat that we project. I can say, personally speaking, the only place I've ever experienced heat illness was in the state of Wisconsin because I didn't have an air conditioner at home. And so when a heat wave hit, I got sick. And that's, you know, the kind of infrastructure gaps that and sort of community resilience gaps that we're going to need to be addressing.
I run away every summer to northern Michigan to escape the heat of Cincinnati, and it sounds like there's really not going to be anywhere that's not severely impacted by this, but by the mid-century is what you're saying.
Yeah, we saw already some change by mid-century, certainly, if we took no action. And unfortunately, some change will happen even if we did take action because of the decisions that we have already made as a society with respect to greenhouse gas emissions. But the good news is that we really can, work to create a safer future if we take rapid action now on climate change. So for example, by late century, if we took rapid action on climate change, we could cap the number of days that Cincinnati sees above 100 degrees Fahrenheit at 26, whereas if we didn't take any action, there would be 66 such days per year. Now, so that's about a month's worth of additional days that we could spare Cincinnati residents being exposed to 100 degrees Fahrenheit. So there's a lot that we can do. I actually saw a lot of reasons for hope in this report.
Well, we'll talk about that in a moment. So just in general, for our listening area, as I said, your report profiled all 50 states. Indiana, part of our listening area, there are typically 4 days a year with a heat index above 100. The report says by the middle of the century, that would increase to 34 days. By the end of the century, 62. Bloomington, Evansville, and Terre Haute would be the most impacted among the larger cities, which you all classified as a population of 50,000 or more. In Ohio, usually there's 1 day a year on average with a plus 100 heat index. That would be 22 by mid-century, 49 by the end of the 21st century. Cincinnati, Dayton, and Middletown, all part of our listening area, would see the highest frequency of these days. And in Kentucky, 6 days usually at plus 100 heat index, 45 by the middle of the century, 76 by the end of the century. Bowling Green, Owensboro, and Louisville would see the highest frequency. So I guess, why would cities like Cincinnati and Dayton and Middletown see a higher frequency of those kinds of days?
Yeah, it's a great question. Some of it is the geography, looking at, you know, certainly the number of days above particular thresholds that we look at here. As you get further and further south in the country, those number of days that traverse those extreme heat thresholds generally increases. And some of it has to do, you know, with location with respect to, is it, you know, in the eastern part of the country where there's more humidity than the western part of the country. So kind of as you get into the more humid areas, that certainly makes the feels like temperature higher. So you can kind of think of those general patterns that we already have and how they'll be exacerbated in a warmer world.
Our conversation about climate change in Cincinnati will continue after this short break, and you can join our conversation if you have questions or comments, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A new report says it's only going to get hotter around here. By the end of the century, we'll see more and more days with high heat indices. That means feeling above 90, feeling above 100. We're going to have more of those days. So let's continue now with Rachel Licker. She's a senior climate scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. You can join our conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or join us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets. We'll remind our listeners what we just went over. Basically, we have just a few days each year here in Indiana, Ohio, and Kentucky where we have a heat index above 100. That's when it feels like more than 100 degrees outside. But by the middle of the century, that could increase sometimes eightfold. And by the end of the year, 62 such days in Indiana. We could see 49 of those days by the middle of the century, or by the end of the century in Ohio, mostly impacting Cincinnati, Dayton, and Middletown. 6 days usually each year in Kentucky now, but 76 by the end of the century. So, Rachel, people who are hearing this and thinking, oh man, it's already so hot in the summer here, and we're going to have more days like this as the years progress, and they're wondering, what can be done to slow this down? I know you've touched on a few things already, but what is the response from science about what individuals can start to do?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the most, what we really point to in our report is the need for collective action. So demanding that our policymakers, our decision makers really be working to, on the one hand, work to slow climate change and limit how many of these dangerously hot days we're going to be facing around the country, and taking measures at the community, state, and federal level to help keep people safe in the face of extreme heat. So, you know, what does that mean? What do we want to ask our policymakers to do? Well, we need to be, you know, asking them to stick to the commitments made in the Paris Climate Agreement, for starters. Obviously, this is a global problem, but we need to be doing our part, and we need to transition to a low-carbon economy, including transitioning our energy system to low-carbon energy sources, ramping up energy efficiency, electrifying as many energy systems as possible, and also working to develop land management practices, whether it be in agricultural or forest systems that store more carbon. And then, as I mentioned, you know, we really need to be keeping people safe from heat. We need to make sure that we have the best early warning systems in place possible, that all residents are able to access cooling centers, and communities have policies in place to, you know, ensure that we're checking in on our older residents or individuals with pre-existing health conditions to make sure that we can get them to safety, and also make sure our infrastructure can actually handle the heat. You know, I lived in a condition last year here in Washington, D.C., where I am at the moment, where the heat index got really hot and we had a power surge in our community, and the power went out when the heat index was 110 degrees Fahrenheit, and we were without power for a few days while the utilities got it back up and running. So, you know, we need to make sure that our grid system can also withstand the heat and make sure that people can stay cool.
What about how we get people to understand the urgency or even the realness of this situation? You do have a lot of people who deny whether climate change is real. What type of conversations do we need to be having on the ground?
Certainly, it's a complex thing. You know, can you actually convince someone to change their mind or not? You know, I think we need to be, well, we really hoped with this report that we could help bring climate change home to people so they could really see, you know, how is my community going to fare? What are the consequences of making, you know, different decisions? What if we do this? What if we do that? You know, what are the consequences in the near term, too? So we were hoping that this report could really start to fill in that picture, because oftentimes we hear about global warming in more abstract terms. So being able to say, you know, hey, the city of Cincinnati has, historically had 4 days per year on average with a heat index above 100 degrees Fahrenheit. But, you know, if we don't take any action, those kinds of days could increase by the end of the century to 66. But there's a lot we could do if we did take action. We could cap that at 26 days per year. So, you know, trying to get more granular. And I think we also need to be having more civil dialogues across the political aisle, you know, bringing different members of our communities together to be able to see, you know, this doesn't need to be such a political discussion. We're talking about science. We're talking about our futures and what's at stake, our children, our grandchildren. And, you know, there are a lot of solutions here that are win-win-wins, like I'm saying. You know, if we're investing in clean energy, we can help to reduce home energy bills, improve air pollution, and, you know, the consequences for human health during a heat wave, and also get at climate change at the same time. So there's a lot that we can do that helps solve a number of problems at the same time.
When I think about some of the things individuals do, maybe they turn their AC off when they're not in the house, or maybe they drive an electric car or use a paper straw instead of a plastic one. Is that beneficial if more people aren't doing that?
It is. I think it's extremely important that we all be trying to take those actions. This is really a situation where we need all hands on deck. And we also need our government to be making it easier for people to take those kinds of measures. You know, we've seen rollbacks in the subsidies that make it more affordable for people to invest in energy-efficient air conditioning units. I've had family members who were in a really, you know, put in unfortunate situations where they needed a new air conditioning unit, and a more energy efficient one was more than $1,000 more, and they didn't have access to the subsidies anymore to be able to make that purchase more affordable. And so, you know, we really need our government to be making it easier for us to take these steps, because the individual actions do matter and they add up.
But that applies to global nations as well, whether there are enough participating in this. And you referenced the Paris Agreement on climate change. The United States intends to withdraw from this. If our country follows through with that, what could the implications be?
Yeah, so I mean, there are a couple of different ways to think about it. First of all, you know, in the absence of leadership by the United States at the federal level on climate change, we've seen a lot of communities and states and private businesses stepping up to try to fill in the gap that's been left by the federal government. But at the same time, there's nothing like, you know, the leadership and the signals sent by the federal government. So we really, you know, that's undoubtedly going to make it more difficult to meet the commitments made to the Paris Climate Agreement. And then there's the reality that the United States is, you know, the leader in the world on many issues. And so it sends a bad signal that, you know, it's okay to scale back efforts when we really need to be ramping up ambition on climate change at the moment. You know, we already see some other countries starting to waffle a bit, and it seems like, you know, that's a bit in response to seeing the U.S. scale back and change course on climate change. So we really do need to be putting that pressure on our decision makers to be acting to stay, help our residents stay safe at home, but then also to make sure that, you know, because this is a global problem, that we're not kind of helping the entire world change course in a negative way.
We're talking a lot about climate change this summer because of that record-setting July, because of that melting ice we saw in Greenland, and because of the Democratic presidential primary where some questions were asked and we heard from candidates on where they stand on the issue. But I'm also wondering, Rachel, based on some reporting and opinion pieces that I've read, is it too late?
No. I mean, that's exactly what our report underscores. Our report underscores that there is a big difference in how dangerous things could get if we don't take action versus if we do right now. So it's definitely not too late. I'm a new mother. I have a daughter, and I look at the results of our work, and I see a future that could be a lot better for her, you know, if we are investing in these different clean energy sources and taking action and coming together as a society to really chart a safer path forward. So, you know, I wouldn't be in this line of work if I didn't think there was hope.
I read an opinion column in Newsweek written by Michael Mann. It was published just yesterday. And I want to read a quick quote from it. Quote, "Those of us who actively work both on the science of climate change and the communication thereof, however, know that it isn't hyperbole to point out that we have barely more than a decade to pull off a major overhaul in our energy economy if we are to avert dangerous more than 1.5 Celsius planetary warming. That having been said, we don't go off a, quote, climate cliff at 1.5 degrees Celsius warming. It's more like an ever more dangerous highway that we're going down. We might miss the 1.5 degrees Celsius exit despite concerted action. We would still be far better off getting off at the next, say, 2 degrees Celsius exit than continuing headlong down the dangerous carbon highway." So does that mean that maybe we have missed some opportunities to reach a point where we could improve this even more, and now we're finding ourselves settling for what is achievable?
Certainly that's one way to think about it. I mean, there is a certain level of change that is happening and will happen because of the decisions that we've already made, and our opportunity to stave off those really dangerous impacts that are kind of on our horizon. The time that we have to do that is starting to run out. But nevertheless, you know, there's a difference between living in a world in which you have a few days a week per year that you have really extreme temperatures and living in a world where you have just months and months and you're spending your entire summer indoors away from the heat. So, you know, there's a lot of power in the choices that we make right now. And I think there's no reason to give up on hope for this.
We do get mixed messages from the federal government. We've talked about the climate, the Paris Climate Agreement. We hear Democratic candidates expressing different ideas about that issue. But NASA is pretty clear on this. Its website states, quote, responding to climate change will involve a two-tier approach. One, mitigation, reducing the flow of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And two, adaptation, learning to live with and adapt to the climate change that has already been set in motion. But NASA goes on to note that this is a global problem. It requires participation from all nations. And this was something we were starting to touch on with the Paris climate discussion. That's what seems to be most daunting about this. How does this coordination happen? All these different countries all around the world, we're all breathing the same air and all impacting that air with our own policies. How do we get that coordination in order?
Yeah, that was what was so amazing about the Paris Climate Agreement, that we were able to have a universally accepted agreement to not only keep warming to below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, which is sort of a funny, like, well, that doesn't sound like a lot, but, you know, when you have that level of increase, it manifests in more extreme heat days, more large wildfires, stronger hurricanes, etc. We were even to get an ambition to keep warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. So the fact that we were able to have, you know, enough efforts and to get all these countries to come together to sign on to this agreement, that's why it's so important for the U.S. to get back on track in that agreement, because, you know, we really can't be veering off course. That was pretty remarkable that that was able to be pulled off the first time, you know, and we really need to be now focusing on